What was the first thing that you can remember?
The settling of the Civil War.
How did you hear about that?
Well, it came through by a man on horseback. Came through the mountain, up through the mountain roads.
You said, the other time we were here, you said something about the first time that railroad came through there.
Hello, this is Goofy Greg. Greg to me.
I don't know, I can't just explain it. It was a surprise. It was quite a sight to see a steam car come through there. We hadn't heard much of it before it got through. And the engine that they had on to draw the gravel and stuff and ties and rails, old Nancy, I think they called her. And she jumped track every little while and jumped back on again.
You know, the big four airs. I remember that. My father used to get the Saturday Evening Post every week or two for us boys to see the pictures in it, you know, the fires that caused it. You read about that in history now, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember seeing that all in picture in the paper when I was a boy. And they had another big fire here in Ulster. That country all burned over. And then that's, I think, only 67 or 68. And I can remember that too. My father and I was a visit upon the hill, and they carried me and showed me that great raft of red fire burning there. And I can remember just as well as what's Orchester. Never forgot it. My father and mother came from my grandfather on my mother's side. That's the one that knit the net. She was a mechanic. Her grandmother, was a full-blooded Indian. She was a quarter Indian.
Mm-hmm.
Cynthia Anson, the chief on Glade Hill Mountain there, he was one of the chiefs of Delaware, owned quite a big territorial land there. And his daughter married a Scotchman, Charles Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a big family, some 8 or 9 boys.
Mm-hmm.
And they grew up there. And you see, they were half Indian because she was a full-blooded Indian and he was a Scotchman. So my mother, you see, was one of Charles Smith, the second son's daughter, and that made her half Indian now. So that would make me around about an eighth Indian, see? And my father on my father's side, Vandermarsch, they came from Holland over in this country in about 1600 and something, you know, in the 1600s, the first time the French come in here, you know, and Holland people, and they settle down along the Hudson River. They settle down there along the river and come over around Highland. From the Highland, they come over around Rosendale, High Falls. That was their native country. My grandfather worked down that canal, Delaware Hudson Canal, when it was built, and was a water boy on it. He told me, and from there he come up in there to Lackawack, then, and married one of Kay Sheely's daughters. Sold a lot of land, had it cleared off. The way he got that land all cleared, he had hundreds of acres cleared there. Some men would, if you had it then, work or starve, you know. In the wintertime, men working, single men and married men, cut down fallers and burned them, don't you see, and put rye on them. And he gave them the first crop of rye to clear. Well, they planted a crop of rye and gathered that they had that, and then the land would be cleared, and he'd furnish grass seed, and they'd seed it, and if they wanted to buy it, they'd build a log house on it, move on to it. Have a cow and some of them get oxen. They'd have a cow and live on to it and work her out best they could around. But they had to raise the rye to get something to live on in them days.
Mm-hmm.
They raised some buckwheat, principally what they raised was rye.
I don't know if this work, these mics are working or not, and I guess probably they are. I have down home a bill of sale, the slave, dated 1795. a black man called Jack. And he was sold from father to son for the sum, a present sum, of about $150. This indenture is made out so that there be no possible doubt but what this man, once the deal had been made, but what he was literally sold as a slave. Black Jackie. Well, going back to the original part of it, he was sold from father to son. He was sold by one of the first white settlers down there in the upper reservoir region where I live, right directly across the Ashington Reservoir from where I live on West Shokan Heights. He was a Hollander named Jan Verspel, and he sold the slave to his son Thomas, who Thomas, incidentally, was a veteran of the Revolutionary War, and he had the distinction of serving legitimately on both sides of Americans and British forces. He was taken prisoner at the Battle of Long Island, and he was imprisoned among hundreds of others in that infamous old prison called the Sugar House. And it seems that the conditions were so terribly bad there that the British were very anxious to gather recruits from the American side like that to use as spies and so forth, and they offered very fabulous sums for those days and special concessions. But old man Crispell, he said the only possible way he would consider of enrolling under the British Lion was that if he wouldn't have to fight against his countrymen. So they sent him up to Halifax, the British naval base there, where he did duty till after the close of the war, when he came home about 1783, and he brought a conch shell with him. I guess that's what they call it. It's a blow on dinner horn. It's somewhere down the place, there around the place yet. And he was the man from father to son who old Jackie was sold to. And about the time of the war of 1812, Jackie was getting fairly well along in years, and this Thomas Crispell's son, Abram, he and the old colored fellow didn't get along very good. And so he delivered an ultimatum to his father that they'd either have to part with one or the other. And so, in order to keep peace in the family, the old man, Abram Crispell, he gave old Jackie his freedom. And that went along fine. They helped him build a log cabin up along the stream now known as the Jackie Brook, a short distance south of where the present Olive Library is, formerly the West Shokan Schoolhouse.
Did they make a good living?
Yeah.
Frank, did these families that came here and worked like that, did they make a good living?
Well, they lived. That's the way. People lived because years ago, toward what we're doing today, we were only slaves. You imagine, when I was about 18 years old, I worked in the quarry, and I cut stone for a dollar and a quarter a day, and if you laid your hammer down, you'd have a man hollering at you, see? And you were working 10 hours, slashing into it. You couldn't limit your work like you can today. If you were working on those jobs today, and you were cutting curbs, and you had the limit, that's where they couldn't holler. You could take your time, see? As the other fella, didn't get his limit, or he had rough stone, he had a chance to catch up with you today. But at them times, done all you could do, that's all. They wanted to get all. And when you had finished, if you couldn't do it anymore, you had nothing more coming. Or if you got hurt and you couldn't do your work, you could just go on out to the choir.
It was in Milanville, about 50 miles below Hancock, and I was about 16 years old, where they put in a large raft of war timber, or as we called it in this country, taco timber. Most of the smash-ups was on the river between Hancock and Trenton, and so much rough water and everything that and some of the steersmen wasn't, well, they were steersmen, but they wasn't equal to some of the others, and they'd get to put up on a bridge pier or something, smash up into it, split the raft up, tear it to pieces. And you see, there's lots of water. There was Powell Rift. It's very swift. Well, and then there's right below that's what we used to call a cellar hole. They call it Butler's now. And there's another bad place. Well, then you go just below that, and there's Sawmill Rift. And many a raft has got busted up on that Sawmill Rift bridge pier.
How many men did you ever see?
They used to get once in a while thrown out in the river or something like that.
What about the time you were thrown out?
I myself, one time, went down what they call Shaver's Turn. That's about five or six miles below Arena. We struck a root there, tore out three or four logs out of the one side, and I jumped over one way as they come around, and I hadn't any more.
It's what come around?
The oar. The oar come around.
This is what you steered the raft to.
Yes, that's what you
and
steered the raft
to. There was one on front and one on the rear.
One on front and one on behind. And when I jumped over the oar, I hadn't any more and jumped over the oar, for it struck me and knocked me about 30 feet out in the river. When the raft come around, I'd come up and come on the hind end of the raft. But we landed in the eddy just below there, and next morning gathered up our logs and put them back and went on down the river.
Now, I would like to hear you say a little bit about the last rafting trip that went from Arena down the Delaware. This is interesting.
Well, the last raft was 59 years ago.
That would be 1889, right?
Yeah, 1889.
What part of the year?
It was in April. Four part of April. And we rafted that. That was basswood logs. We rafted at Arena and run it to Trenton, New Jersey. That's the one I got knocked in the river on. Yes, just about the same. Yes.
Were you sorry it was the last trip that you were taking?
Yes, I was sorry at the last trip I was taking.
You liked rafting?
I liked rafting. It was pleasure. It was pleasure to be on a raft. Of course, sometimes it was very cold and raw, rainy and such things as that, but when it was nice weather, it was a beautiful trip. The sights to see along that Delaware River is the most wonderful things. You wouldn't think that it was even in the United States, that is, this part of the country.
Well, for example, through the water gap, the Delaware water
gap.
Yes,
the water gap. And way above the water gap, to Carr's Rock and Death Eddy and them places. The rocks run up there probably 150 to 200 feet high, and nothing but a smooth face of rock. Well, then when you go down, there's a place down just below Port Jervis that they call the sheep pasture. Always the old Rapman called it the sheep pasture. Well, there's probably 4 or 5 miles down the river. It's nothing but a gray rock, just a smooth gray rock, back as far as you can see, right steep, not too steep, but what you can walk up it or walk on it, and it's all full of crevices, and in them crevices, it's all a little evergreen grows up about 2 or 3 feet high, in all shapes and all forms. Some of it's 10 acres, some of it is a quarter of an acre, and some of it ain't bigger than a small room, all over that sheep pasture.
It must have been wonderful to see that going down on the
raft. It is wonderful to
see. Well, I want to ask you another question. Real interest to people.
Yeah, well.
You told about calling Pennsylvania, Jersey,
yes.
And so on.
You see?
Would you tell what they're about?
Yes, that's it. Now, if they wanted the raft, to pull the far end of the raft on the far oarsman, if they wanted to pull Jersey, if they wanted to go pull Jersey, you know, they'd holler Jersey. Well, then the man would dip
that
his...
That means toward Jersey.
That means to dip your oar so as to pull it towards the Jersey shore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you hollered Pennsylvania, then you dipped it to pull your raft towards the Pennsylvania shore.
Were there any other calls?
Mr. Slack, I wonder, from your mentioning the point on a Delaware called Old Butler's, I wondered whether you'd ever run into this rafting song that we picked up. It was supposed to be about Big Mose, who's a famous character around those parts, or so I've been told. And the song goes like this. We swung around Old Butler's, no danger did we fear, until we came to Sawmill Rift and went plumb against the pier. And there's a chorus, and short around the grog boys, a chorus round the room, for we're the boys that fear no noise, although we're far from home.
That's correct.
You ever heard that song?
Yes, I've heard it. And
maybe
I'm going to tell
it.
You, Boney Quillen made up that song. Quillen himself made that song up. This fellow might have had the song. I've heard that is the truth. That is very true. Boney used to do that, you know. He used to make up them songs, and he'd make up wonderful songs. He'd just make them up, and most always, the biggest part of his songs was all made up on Boney.
There's one more verse here. It goes like this. There was a man upon the raft. His name it was Big Mose. He hopped around among the logs and saved most all our clothes.
Yes. Yeah, I feared it. Oh, I feared it when I was a... Yes, and you know, listen, gentlemen, if I'd have known what I know now, I could have had hundreds of old songs, as you might say, but I wasn't a singer, and I never paid no attention to them or nothing. All them songs, I heard that song sung clean through time and time and again. A great song. It was a nice song, too. Yeah, yes.
I think is very funny. To me, it's cunning. Because it's so typical of this man, Boney Quillen. He was an Irishman with all of the wit that ever was born in any Irishman. He was smart and came back just like that always. He went down with the crew of raftmen and at one of the hotels way down where they stayed overnight. The proprietor's name was Kiesler. But the men, those raftmen, they wouldn't bother to say Kiesler always. They called him Kiesel, Mr. Kiesel. So in the evening after supper, this man Quillen was always wheedling hotel keepers out of a drink. Not so much because he just felt that he had to have a drink, but nothing pleased him more than to be able to trim somebody a little bit like that, beat someone out of a drink. So he said to Mr. Kiesler, Mr. Kiesler, I'd like to compose an epitaph for your tombstone when you die. Well, Kiesler thought that would be all right, so he said, go ahead, Boney, and do it. Boney said, Mr. Kiesler died of late, by angels waft to heaven's gate. Then he stopped. Didn't say another word for a minute and looked very wishful at Mr. Kiesler, the hotel proprietor, and Kiesler knew very well what was in his mind, what he wanted. He said, no, Sir Boney, there's no more drinking. Up slipped the devil, sly as a weasel, and down to hell he kicked old Kiesler.
Raising, and they got the timbers out with the axe that they had on exhibition yesterday. This axe, they would mark the timbers with a blue line, and then they would hew. They'd set days and get those timbers in preparation. And when they were ready, they would notify everybody in the neighborhood, and everybody would drop their work, and then they'd go home and do their chores at night, and then their wives would come back and they'd each bring something to eat. And they would have a fiddler. Sometimes they'd be several in the crowd that could play for their dancing. And they'd dance for a while. And the way they used to dance, they would the floor wouldn't be cleared when the next couples would take their place. So that one set would really push the other set off the floor. And they would dance for a certain length of time, and then usually they'd have hot coffee and cakes and sandwiches and pie. Of course, that's something we don't know much about today, but then pumpkin pies, I've seen them baked in 8-quart pans. And they were really delicious. And mince pie was a great pie because so many dried fruits could be used, which people had to use a great deal of then because they didn't know about canning.
I am a poor lucky chap, I'm very fond of rum. I was a lump more light, ain't ashamed to bum. Feet sore, cold, sore, yet I did not complain. Got up on my eyes and my turkey and I walked the road again. I walked the road again, my boys, I walked the road again. If the weather was fair, I'll comb my hair, I'd walk the road. From New York into Buffalo, I walked it all the way. Slept in brickyard along barns until the break of day. Feet were sore, cold, sore. Got up on my eyes and my turkey and I walked again. I walked the road again, my boys, I walked the road again. The weather was fair, I'd comb my hair, I'd walk the road again. Working in the Susquehanna yard, I got the dollar a day. Towing hard to make it, and boys, I hardly think she paid. Said they need a wages, if so, I won't complain. They don't like ice my turkey, and I'll walk the road again. I walk the road again, boys, walk the road again. The weather was fair, I'd comb my hair and walk the road again. Worked along for about a month, and I did get the cash. I went on it pretty, boy, money went kismash. Devil said I had left. Yet I didn't complain. Got up on my head and my turkey and I walked the road again. I walked the road again, boys, I walked the road again. The weather was fair, I'd comb my hair and walked the road again.
Well, it's Uncle Alfred. My uncle, and they decided they'd go away so they wouldn't get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much anti-rent trouble then. So that night they went up to Bed Hollow, where the man was, and stayed half the night,
mm-hmm.
and then. Went on their journey through the woods, and they followed the North Star. They could see it through the trees,
mm-hmm.
and they followed it. And I didn't tell you about they had their rifle and their blanket, but and so they went on, and I can't tell you about their sleeping overnight, whether they slept overnight or not,
mm-hmm.
but they must have. Because they got tired and hungry, and that's the reason they seen that come to this clearing, quite a big clearing and a garden, and the smoke coming out the chimney, and they stopped there and asked for food, and the young girl come to the door,
And she said, well, I got bread, rye bread in the oven of bacon, and I got plenty of milk. Now I got ahead of my story. I'll give you the crust off in the bread to eat with the milk when it gets cool. And so they ate their breakfast, and such a delicious breakfast they had, they said. And they offered her money, but she wouldn't take anything for the money, for the breakfast. Her folks, now I left out some again, that her folks should be in a way.
Hiram Graham, yes.
That was my grandfather.
Thank you.
That was my grandfather.
Uh-huh. You remember him?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. I was brought up in Marion before he died.
Uh-huh. Was he quite a hunter?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
He was quite a hunter and a fisherman. He was a great fisherman. He liked to fish.
Uh-huh.
I remember him and my father. They used to go out hunting and be gone, you know, 3-4 days, maybe longer. They'd take the Mother said they didn't usually take too much for them to eat, only bread and butter. And then they expected to get their meat on their way.
Mm-hmm.
And she said one morning there was such a hurry they couldn't do the chores before they went. And she went to the barn to do the chores, and the colt was down. They had a colt, and that colt was down, and he was fastened in the halter, so she couldn't get him up. And she went out and she screamed fire. She says, I thought there wasn't no sight so far away but they'd hear me. So she said, I screamed fire, fire. And they thought the house had caught fire, and they come a rushing back.
That was the only way to get them back.
That was the only way to get them back. And so she got them back and got the colt loose and got up. She said, I was afraid the colt was strangled to death. He had the halter around his neck. And so she said, I just screamed fire, and it brought him. No, not sign of all.
We are interested if there were any stories about the anti-rent wars.
I had been so disgusted by myself, think that I didn't ask my grandfather, because he knew all about that. You know?
He did, uh-huh. Was his land involved in the, was he a tenant?
Well, no, he owned the farm way up in there.
Uh-huh.
But he was present the time that Steele was shot.
He was.
He was right there. And I've always wondered. He said, of course, there was just muzzle-loading guns them days. And whoever was captain or the head man, I don't know just what they called him. But anyway, Grandfather Graham, he said, this fellow would give the order that every man had a gun that wasn't loaded to load it. And Grandfather, I says, I grabbed him with his arm. I said, for the Lord's sake, recall that order. And so he recalled the order.
Hmm.
But I wondered if his one of the guns was empty, wasn't his.
Hmm.
Of course, I didn't know that. But now I could have heard all about that if I, well, but I guess I wasn't old enough to be interested.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard him tell that, and I thought that was kind of funny.
Hmm. You know, one of the leaders was Warren Scudder. And I wondered, somebody I believe said that he lived around here somewhere, is that right?
I don't think he lived around here. And wasn't that in the Anne Arendt War where the Ben, you know, would go out and hide?
That's right. They, for a long time, some of them left the country and some of them hid. I think Mike told about some man who went up to the Erie Canal and went out west and then came back later.
Yes, I think my uncle went.
Uh-huh.
But now I know Grandfather Graham told about, he was in the woods and he heard these men talking and they was after him. And so we said he was right almost on the brink of a ledge. So he says, I went and I grabbed a big rock, all I could hold, and rolled it over that ledge. And then he said, I run hid in the brush. And he said, they come and looked over there. And they said, well, if he's gone over there, he's dead anyways. You know, we were looking for him.
Hmm.
And he said,
that horn blow again?
Yes. And that was supposed to be the signal, I guess. As I was saying a while ago, the costume was torn. When we tore the house down, the costume was burned up. It was when I was 7, and I can't remember what it looked like. And no one ever was very proud about having them around at that time. They used to hide them under logs out in the woods at the time when they did actually use them. They didn't ever bring them into their homes and keep them where anyone could find them. They usually hid them under an old log or in a hollow tree or some spot where it was safe and didn't bring them to the house.
Well, would you tell the story of Warren Scudder first?
Well, so well as I remember, the way my father told me, Warren Scudder was the brother of Aaron Scudder's father, who was John Scudder's grandfather, and lived right over here in his grandfather's home. And along about the time of the anti-rent difficulties, when they grouped together to get after Sheriff Steele's sale of Jingle Hill that morning. He was one of the men who went armed to see what they could do, if they could stop the sale or make some effort to stop the sale. And he was one of them who shot at Steele when he let the bars down to go in to sell this man's cows and the rest of his property. And of course there were several other shots at the same time, but he always claimed it was his shot that brought Steele down, because he was quite an expert marksman. At least he skipped the country. They used to claim that he went down into Louisiana, probably New Orleans or someplace, to hide out, but the local people always thought he lived up here in the cave for a good many years during the time that he supposed to be hiding out in the south. And they hunted for him. Even the authorities suspected him being there. They tracked down two or three other of the guys that they thought might have shot Steele, and I guess they had 7 arrested at one time. But it was in this cave where he tells my father he hid out. And to show my father one time what a good marksman he was — he was an old man at that time, probably in the 80s, he had him get his old favorite gun out, the one that he was supposed to shot Steele with, and he put up a beehive made of quite thick inch boards, like they used to be in those days, a little square box of a beehive, and a certain number of paces, I've forgotten now, I've heard Father tell, and he shot right through it, the first shot. So he was considered to be a pretty good marksman, much better than that, I guess, when he was young. Well, during the Civil War, there were several others.
Could you tell us that which storm you told us last year?
Which one? I was about, I told you so many.
About your mother and the
the old hat?
Yeah, the old hat.
The box. Well, that was true. That was no regular story. I saw that myself and know it. That my mother and father, when my grandmother came to the house one day, and she said to my mother, "Lavinia, are you and Drake having trouble?" She said, "No." Well, she said, "Why is it that you don't seem to feel good or something?" She said, "Ma, I'm going to tell you." She said, "There's something bothers me nice. There's an old man and an old woman comes on my bed." And she said, "I kick after them, and when I kick, they'll be somewhere else." And she said, "I can say this to my father, Jake," she called. "Jake, don't you see them?" "No, I don't see them." "Well, they're there." So Grandma said to my mother, she said, Lavinia, I'll tell you what you do. She said, when the next time you see him, she says, give him a good calling down. Curse at him. Oh, Ma said, that's something I never do. Well, she said, you do it. Call him anything. So Ma did. So after a while, she wasn't bothered anymore. Well, my father bought my uncle's house right down below where we live. And upstairs on the, well, we always called it the rafter, there was two across. And it had a big round box on it, standing way up on it, like the old-fashioned cheese boxes used to be. So we went down there and we said, let's look and see what's in that box. Well, Ma had told Grandma how they were dressed. She said the old woman had an old hood on, and the man had an old black hat. And she said they're always dressed that same way. So he took the box down, and when my father opened it, he said it had the old black hood and the old black hat into it, and it had a Dutch Bible in it. That was pretty well worn, but anyway. Pa said, close the box right up and let's take it up home. He said, let Vine see it. That was my mother. So he took the box up and he said, took it in. And he said, Vine, I got something I want to show you. Well, when he opened the box, she jumped back like that. She said, my God. Pa said, what's the matter? She said, there's that old hood and that old hat that man and woman used to wear. Well, it was an old couple that lived in. And they both had the, well, both of them had the name of being a witch. She said, burn them up. Burn up.
Let me see now. Before I get on the subject of growl, I'm not exactly tuned up, but there's a little song ditty kind of comes to my mind. Us young fellows used to get together and have a song fest and butcher two or three chickens and have some good old hard cider. And one of the fellows, John Rose, played the banjo, and we used to harmonize. One of her favorite songs was Carry Me Back to Old Virginia, which all of you have heard, of course. And another one was just a plain little ditty, like myself, didn't amount to very much, and went something like this. Let me see. Well, maybe I'll have to tell about Uncle Rollo. Oh, I got it. Grasshopper sitting, maybe I'm too high. Grasshopper sitting on a railroad track, and his bones shall rise again. He was picking his teeth with a cough attack, and his bones shall rise again. Oh Lord, another year we may be gone, laying some lonesome graveyard. Oh Lord, alone. Adam and Eve climb up a tree, Adam's bones will rise again. Eve got stung with a bumblebee, and her bones will rise again. Oh Lord, another year we may be gone, laying some lonesome graveyard. Oh Lord, alone. That's enough of that. Well, I told you folks.
How about Rowell and the Rattlesnake?
I told you folks about Rowell Bell so many times that that's getting kind of.
But these are other folks.
These are other folks. Well, I've got three of his pictures there, and the old 100-year-old Colt revolver that used to shoot the rattlesnakes with when Uncle Rowell and his brother used to go up on the way to High Point on South Mountain, overlooking into South Hollow, where the big ledges are, where the rattlesnake den was supposed to be. And I dare say Mr. Vanderbilt, I don't even recognize him down there. He probably knows about that rattlesnake den. But anyway, I used to go up there, Uncle Rowell fiddled off the rattlesnakes. When they come out, his brother, he used to shoot them with this very early Colt pistol I got here. I gotta sit down a little bit. I can't tune up as quick as Grant can. But I assure you in the first place, this thing isn't loaded. If it was, I'd be just straight up as you folks are. But it is an early model Colt's pistol, known as an Ellis Patton, and it has a side hammer onto it, which they were popular about and before the Civil War. It is a .31 caliber. and it is a six shot and loads with powder and ball with a percussion cap. Well, Raul fiddled the rattlesnakes out, and his brother would take a pot shot at him and kill the snakes. And I've been told, which I believe to be true in every way, not exaggerated, that they have killed as many as 26 rattlesnakes in one day.
Was there any particular tune that the rattlesnakes liked?
Well, they could have been. They probably liked that one about Grant's been saying.
What were those tunes that you said that Raul played?
Well, one was Sail on a Log, the other was The Devil Shooting Crows on the Mississippi, and another was Kate's Got the Bellyache. Well, so long ago, I don't remember any of the tunes, but I've seen him fiddle lots and lots of times. And as I told the younger crowd here, he used to take a gallon kerosene can and go down to Kingston and get a gallon of Ackee Hall's, he called it, and mix it with a little rattlesnake venom, and made a very potent drink. Raul would bring the kerosene can to get off the train down what used to be the Shokan Depot and paddle on up the street up towards South Mountain. Anybody asked him what they had, why he had a gallon of kerosene, so they didn't ask him for a drink. I don't know why that just prompted me a little bit. This mic, I'm not got used to that. It's only got stage fright, you see, just a little bit. A little gun shy, in other words.
Well, you were telling about how old was Raul?
Raul was about 85 years old when he died. He died in September 1906. Oh, I got Raul's tune now. I pour it loose. You can kind of help me out around that. I'm saying I'm signing too loud, or I can't tell from here.
Just right.
Oh, I heard a rumbling in the sky. It imitated thunder. If my good wife gets back again, 'twill surely be a wonder. Now look at here, and look at there, and look way over yonder. And can't you see the old gray goose a-smiling at the gander? On one Saturday night, that good wife died, and Sunday she was burying. But Monday was my courting day, and Tuesday I got marrying. Now look at here, and look at there, and look way over yonder. And can't you see the old gray goose a-smiling at the gander? Now, folks, I haven't heard that in nearly 45 years. And I heard my old Uncle Jake Respell and his nephew Jake Smith sing it at Uncle Jake's 72nd birthday party over in Ashokan. That's the only time I ever heard it really sung, and the verses are kind of separated. There's a whole string of them, but that's all I remember.
Mike would do some work in the shop or build something, and Mike had said, "Isn't very pretty for nice, but it's hell for stalks." That's one of his best expressions.
Let's see, what were some of the other stories?
I can tell you the one about that brings out how handy Mike was with a gun.
Yeah.
I and Mike sat on the high point of Forge Rocks here with guns between us that we'd been hunting kingfishers with along the creek, and visiting. Up the creek comes this kingfisher. You probably know what they are. And I reach for a gun, and Mike does. But Mike shoots the kingfisher while I'm trying to find out what's the matter with the gun, because he had the wrong gun. But the wrong gun didn't bother Mike. He'd shoot the kingfisher all right. But he lived with the gun in his hand, practically.
And you were comparing... Now, would you tell the story about Mrs. Haynes' father and Mike?
Oh. Well, Lena's father lived opposite Gould's Bridge, just above the four postmaster there.
Uh-huh.
Mike and several men got poaching and full of hard cider and feeling pretty good, and they thought they'd throw the creek watcher, Charlie, in the creek. So they send a couple men up to wake him up, make some noise, and they come back down. all gathered around the rocks and talking what they were doing. And about that time, the creek watcher come down, Mike said, and shot a few bullets through the top of the trees with his little revolver, and the men went in every direction and never did get back together again.
Was that my father that shot the...
What was his name? Charles?
Charlie Knapp.
Knapp. Uh-huh. And now would you tell us the name of the people?
How about it, Chris?
What do you want to hear?
About the
mosquitoes.
About the mosquitoes?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a young fella, I heard about them big mosquitoes down in Georgia. So I made up my mind to go down and see anything that's true about it. I get down there and along about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I go back along the big swamp there where they claim mosquitoes were so fierce. Stand around there. Pretty soon I heard a hum, sound like an aeroplane coming. And I look around and I get closer and closer. Gee, here come a flock of mosquitoes. Boy, I run. They ride after me. Getting closer and closer. I happened to come to a big grass kettle. Oh, great big thing you used to cook sugar cane down. I went to weigh that up to get under, but it weighed 5 tons. I couldn't move it. Look around again, the mosquitoes just about to hit me with a big boot. I picked that up and slid right under.
Nothing.
Well, they hit it with such force, they sunk their bills right through it. I picked up a stone and pinched the bills on the inside. Pretty soon they passed the wind and flew away to kill them.
Wow.
Is that true?
That's true. It ain't the truth, well, then it ain't the truth.
You wouldn't swag come with you.
No.
You tore a strut.
Yeah, he tells about the fish, you know, going through the air.
Uh-huh.
Well, I heard about being so cold up in Klondike.
Now it'd be.
Well, I heard about it, see. Well, I think I'm going up and see how cold it is up there.
Yeah.
So up there I go. That was the year of the blue snow.
Blue?
Come to deep, it took it 2 years to go off.
Mr. Todd has done. First of all, I think that we... Oh, it's all set. First of all, I think we want to want you to know something about what Mr. Todd has done in his life. About how many years were you a forest ranger?
28.
28 years. And for those 28 years, you were on top of Balsam Mountain as an observer. Then you did rafting on the Delaware. How many trips did you take down?
Well, from Hancock, we call it from Hancock, Bordentown, and that's 6 miles below Trenton, 8 miles below Trenton. I made 16 trips in 3 years, three different springs and falls.
Of course, the next question is, did you know Bonnie Quillen?
Yeah, very well.
What was he like? You told me something about him a while ago that I think you ought to repeat.
He was a very comical fella. And he'd sing all night long and make up his own songs and drink as much whiskey as his tongue. Get right up the next morning and go right ahead on a raft and go right on all day just as happy as a lark.
For instance, he has made shingles. You saw the shingle, the fro for splitting shingles. He's made shingles. He has made hoops. And he is going to make us. He's going to stay here. He's going back home and get his working clothes. And he's going to make us some of the tools that we need for our museum. Now, you said you remembered a bear story from, would you tell us that?
It must be the best part of 50 years ago. A man by the name of Billy Yorks and Aaron Graham, two fellows, went with me. Well, I was a young lad, and so was Aaron. About 18, I guess. And Aaron was a little older, and Billy was an older man, and we followed an old bear and two cubs in a ledge. The snow was quite a little snow on, foot deep. Track was old. We found them after a little, and they wouldn't come out. They'd been in there quite a while. They'd got sleeps good and sound, hibernate, you know, for the winter. And we had to build a fire in the hole and smoke them to death, as we thought. They wouldn't come out at all. They shot in the hole and one thing and another, and had muzzle-loading guns, too, that. They wouldn't come out. They had the hole blocked, so they couldn't get out fast. They did try, but they couldn't. They smoked them to death. Well, then the beauty of it was to get them out of there. So they figured they were dead to stop the coughing and so forth.
Would you build a fire right in the entrance of the hole?
Yeah, and lock it up with brush, you know.
Uh-huh.
Hemlock or balsam, whatever we could get, into the snow. I was the smallest of the crowd, so I was elected to go in the hole and end them around and drag them a part way out, get a rope on them so they could pull them out. And when I got in there, I found out that one wasn't dead yet. That was quite an interesting time for me to get out of there backwards.
Talking, I'd like to, would you just say for the record who you are, your name, and so on?
Now?
Yes.
My name is, you want what my name was?
Yes.
My name was Mary Brisbane. Now my name is Scott, Mary Scott.
And you're the daughter of Robert Brisbane. And
William Brisbane was my uncle.
You were young. Your father was alive.
Oh, yes, he is.
And at that time, William Brisbane was out in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
He moved out there shortly after the trouble ending, after he came out of prison.
And he moved to Minnesota before father died, too.
He did. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So that you never got a chance to talk to your uncle about the Anti-Rat War.
No. None of them when I was out there seemed to know anything. Seemingly he hadn't said anything to him about it. You know.
So the most you got was from your father?
Father.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the things that he told you?
Well, he told about that he had to watch out for the posse coming. And one day he was out working in the hayfield and he saw the posse coming. And he had his hay off in windrows. And he crawled under one of those. And the posse turned over every one of those windrows but five, and he was under one of those. I don't know how he felt.
And all during the thing, he lived at home.
Mm-hmm.
But he go during the day and hide somewhere?
Well, kept out watch for the posse coming.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't see him, why, of course, they had to get their work done if they could.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear that story about his saying that he wouldn't turn out for three men that came after him or something like that?
No.
Charlie McLean told a story that...
never heard that one.
You girls remember the story? He saw some strange men around the house, and he just walked right by. And he said that if three men came after him, he wouldn't go out of his way, but if five came after him, he'd climb over the fence and tie it.
He'd be too late when they tied.
Then it was also the story about his, he and one of the Delamater boys were hiding, and Tim Corbin and the posse came by. Did he ever tell you that story? Charlie McLean told it. The Delamater boy had the gun pointed and was about to shoot Tim Corbin as he came around the bend of the road, and your father sort of pushed the gun, and he shot in another direction, and that saved Tim Corbin's life.
they were quite dairy them days.
You told me about your uncle being offered some money.
Yeah, well, he was offered $1,000 to make a speech to the printers, which he didn't believe in, and he wouldn't take it. And they took him to jail and was going to hang him for that. Well, they had a tough time of it down there in that jail. Boy, I've heard.
I guess the women must have had a tough time of it at home.
Oh, they did. My Aunt Janet, that's Uncle William's wife. Why, she had all quite a few little children, you know. And they were so mean, they'd come in and they'd kick everything all over. So smash up her things. But she didn't give up. She kept away at it. They lived at that time over on the Dickman place, where Dickman's lived, Uncle William's did.
I'll put that down because I'd like to visit there sometime and see the house. Is the house still standing?
Yeah, not the one that they had then. They've had it all remodeled and tore down part of it, and there's just a little piece of a house there now.
Oh, yeah.
They tore it all. I forgot who does live over on that place now.
You didn't, of course, Moses Earl wasn't living when you were a young girl was he?
No.
Repeating that little story about Mrs. Kirk.
Yeah. About my brother went down there to help her. It was in the spring, quite a cold day, and she went out with her handkerchief and waved for him to come to the house. So he went to the house, and she said, you must be starving. No, he said he wasn't starving. He wasn't hungry. He meant that he must be awfully cold. I never heard my father make that expression, you know.
That's a Scotch.
They all in Scotland, they call cold, starving.
Were most of the people Scottish?
There was over around home at that time, and now they're mostly Germans. He's hiding from the posse.
Was Steele a big man? Was he real tall?
Who's Steele?
Yeah.
No, I never saw him, you know, never.
Did you ever hear about him?
No, only just that he was right beside father when he was shot.
Is that something your father told you, that he was right beside
him? Yeah. Of course, father had a disguise on that you couldn't tell. He was one of them trying to keep him from selling my cows, you know.
What was his disguise?
It was a deer skin with those little short horns.
Uh-huh.
Somebody stole that.
Uh-huh.
Several's been wanting that. But of course, if it hadn't have been, it wouldn't have been in existence, because I wouldn't have had it. You know what? You don't get is usually destroyed. I didn't get any of the things that from over home. Well, I'd like to have some of them. Out in the hayfield in the summertime, raking, and at nights when I go home from school, go a mile or two after cows. We had two farms, one above the other one. And the cows was always up there on the steep hill. And I used to imagine I could hear a bull after me when I... Boy, couldn't I run.
But you have a dog to go with you, or did you go by
yourself?
Well,
I used to get so out of patience that she was a bird dog. And she'd go chase birds instead of the cows. And we used to have an awful lot of chestnuts up on the other farm. And, you know, squirrels in there. Boy, she wouldn't get your cows for you. And there were two ways the cows could come home. And they might be even home and you hunting after them. They'd go way up the hill and down around back there, and maybe they'd gone on down home before you'd get around your rounds. That used to make you out of patience. To think that you walked all that distance, now there's home. But no more, you know, they had to fence the roads. So they couldn't. I think that was a good idea. used to have a cow dog over home that would go away from our place, clear on above the next one, way up on top of the hill and bring the cows. That one. I would like that. Well, but I think you can get more out of it if you can see the teacher, don't you think so?
I think so, yes.
I think so.
I was interested in you telling us, and I hope you won't mind repeating that little story about Mrs. Kirk?
Yes.
About
my brother went down there to help her. It was in the spring, quite a cold day, and she went out with her handkerchief and waved for him to come to the house. And so he went to the house, and she said, you must be starving. No, he said he wasn't starving. He wasn't hungry. He meant that he must be awfully cold. I never heard my father make that expression, you know.
Is that a Scottish expression?
That's a Scotch. Mm-hmm. They always, in Scotland, they call cold starving.
Were most of the people Scottish?
There was over around home at that time, and now they're mostly Germans.
The neighbors around all get together to give them a real rousing good time, rough time sometimes. They get together with horns, cowbells, or saws out of a little sawmill, anything they can make a terrible noise with.
When does the skimmelton start?
Well, usually after dark, after a couple thinks that everything's all okay, and they're going to have a nice night's rest. I have known them to go as late as 8 o'clock. I have known, years ago, they used to play real bad pranks. I know of a neighbor when I was just young. he's laughing at me now. We had a next door neighbor, and their daughter got married. And they were, some of them got little rocks they got drinking. Sometimes some of the falls would bring drink for them. And they put pepper down the chimney and stuck them in bags on top to get the color to come out. And, oh, they used to put different smelling things. I heard them tell about one time they caught a skunk and got the scent bag down the chimney to get the couple out. that was the old fall. Ricky used to think of all the things. His name's Freda Smith, you heard of.
Freda Smith.
Usually they said Edson. He meant it married Edson's sister.
And then when they
had a sleigh riding party, and from my folks's clear down to the flat, the main road, we could ride a mile and a half in your own hand sleigh, and it was a nice grade.
Just close for a mile and a half.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't go too fast, so that was one of the main things. If it was sleighing at all, we was sleigh riding. And there was two neighbor children on one side and one on the other, and then two to the foot of the hill. Well, as soon as one started riding down the hill, why, we'd start in and each one take a lantern and settle along the way in the dangerous places. So we had to go past the cemetery. So we set a lantern on the cemetery wall, and we didn't think anything of it. Then we had a big set of bobs, and we had one lantern on the front of those bobs. And as that light came down the hill on those bobs, it would go past that light on the wall. There was no man staying in the house on the flat right below us. And when his son and daughter was away at the time, when they came home, he was all worked up into a terrible condition. He said that he seen there was something terrible going to happen because he seen two lights upon the cemetery. And he said somebody was there, and sometimes it was one light, and then there was a lot of lights. And he said they were just there running around up there on the cemetery to beat the band. So that stopped her putting lights on the cemetery.